This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
It now gives me pleasure to introduce Emeritus Professor Henry Nix of the ANU. I'm sure we're all thinking now, gosh, you know, what a loss to science and to Australian culture the loss of Leichhardt was, and that's the title of Henry's presentation.
Thank you, Matthew. In this very brief presentation, I will argue that Leichhardt was indeed a loss to science, and not just Australian science. Science with a capital S. His reputation as an explorer and scientist, unfortunately, although this is now being redressed, really resides on the success of his first overland expedition to Port Essington and the published journal that followed that. And this was judged sufficient at the time for Leichhardt to be awarded honours and gold medals from England, France and Germany. So at the time, the journal was regarded as a valuable product. Now, much attention has been focused on Leichhardt's character, leadership, navigational abilities and bushmanship. How do I move this? Where are we going? Okay. On that expedition, Ludwig Leichhardt, John Gilbert, some very ordinary working men who supported him, and two Aboriginals. And you heard from Tom about his very great interest in Aboriginal knowledge and his desire to include them in his expeditions. And these played a critical role, probably both positive and negative, as it transpired. John Gould, let's move on. The arch villain in this story, Alexander Hugh Chisholm on the left, and John Gould on the right. Both played a significant role in the development of Leichhardt's reputation, posthumously. Just prior to World War II, Chisholm rediscovered Gilbert's long-lost diary among Gould's possessions. And he used it as the basis for publication of a book, Strange New World, first published in 1941 in the middle of World War II, and republished many times since, subsequently with a changed title, Strange Journey. And Chisholm used every twist of his very considerable wordsmithery to denigrate the German Leichhardt and promote the English Gilbert. So this has had an enormous influence on Australian attitudes to Leichhardt. And I'll just give you a quote from a textbook published in 1964, which is a school textbook on Australian explorers, with a foreword by Alex Chisholm. This is: Gilbert, one of Australia's greatest naturalists, was second in command to her, Ludwig Leichhardt, an eccentric, gluttonous, gangling German, then blundering to fame as one of Australia's great explorers. And that really has had an influence. And I'll give you some further examples later, but that's not my major focus. But that's where we've been coming from. I just need to flick on a bit to this figure. Now, this comes from a large format Reader's Digest Atlas published not so long ago, showing the tracks of Australia's great explorers. But it does not include the Port Essington track. It's missing from this. Everybody else is included. But if we go to, what we do have is the Gregory track, which more or less paralleled the major part of the Port Essington track, but in reverse, and that was some 10 years or so later. That's there, but the Leichhardt track of 1844-45 is not there. What I wanted to illustrate, though, if we go over here to this map, the Sturt into the interior, the whole of northern Australia was a blank. It was absolutely unknown, inland from the coast. And the only point of settlement in the whole of the north was Victoria Settlement at Port Essington, and that's where Leichhardt had to get to. He had no supply ships or rescue ships planned to pick them up. They had to get to Port Essington. It was vital. So that in itself is quite an achievement, but that's not the major purpose of my talk. I'll come back. This is a map generated of the campsites of that expedition, which were GPSed by Glenn McLaren, who subsequently gained a PhD from his retracing of the track, much of it on horseback. And in that process, he developed a remarkable respect for Leichhardt's navigation, his field maps, his descriptions, and everything in that journal. Okay, keep going. Just to illustrate a couple of points, this is elevation. You'll see that the initial part of the trip, it paralleled the coast, but it was inland from the Great Escarpment and all the way up to the base of the Gulf and then swung round and round the Gulf itself. Gilbert was lost at a point up there in the Gulf. I think it shows up in the next slide. But one thing that is very interesting is that Leichhardt actually recognised many of the plants all the way up to where they went down from the tableland down onto the Gulf Plain. And that's because of the fact that the divide and the ranges modify the temperature. So there is a great extension of more temperate adapted species all the way north up that track. And it was very disappointing to Gilbert because he only discovered two or three new species of birds because he'd already collected them down around the Darling Downs sometime before. So it was doubly unfortunate that Gilbert was speared just at the time when life would become more interesting for him as it did for Leichhardt. And I think Tom mentioned in a description the great change they detected as they came off the slopes and down onto the Gulf Plain. And there is a major change in biology as you do that, and of course in climate and everything else. Okay. Just let me return then to the journal of the Overland Expedition. We do have Major Thomas Mitchell's assertion in 1846 that a more useless mass of rubbish was never bound up in a book. I think there might have been a mite of jealousy in that. But with due deference to the good Major, who was a great explorer, but not a scientist, let me present a contrary view. 100 years after the Port Essington expedition, at the end of World War II, Australians developed a great concern for the undeveloped and undefended North. Knowledge of the land and water resources and development potential was limited, and indeed, some of the most detailed descriptions of that landscape available were in Leichhardt's journal. The Rural Reconstruction Commission identified the North as a priority, and CSIRO was given the task of improving the knowledge base. And two gentlemen, C.S. Christian and G.A. Stewart developed rapid reconnaissance techniques based on the newly available air photo coverages, which they combined with targeted ground sampling and with concepts of land systems, repeated patterns of broad landscapes that were mapped, and their component land units, the building blocks of landscape that were not. And these surveys involved a well-equipped team of specialists. There were no Leichhardts then. We needed specially trained people. We didn't have a Leichhardt. These invariably comprised a geologist, geomorphologist, a botanist, a soil scientist, a climatologist usually, often backed up by a land evaluation expert, an economist, and sometimes a wildlife expert. Now, all of these disciplines were within Leichhardt's portfolio of training, and they were deliberately undertaken to prepare him for the work that he wished to undertake. And they were all in one person's head, not in a team. And as you know, getting a team to work together is not always effective. So Christian and Stewart began the monumental task promptly. They produced their first report in 1946, straight after the war. In the next 30 years, these covered most of northern Australia and all of Papua New Guinea. 12 of these surveys virtually completely overlay the Port Essington track, and I was personally involved in a number of these in the south, particularly, but also in the north. And I have to affirm that all of those teams referred to the Ludwig Leichhardt Journal and had profound respect for his ability to read and describe landscapes accurately. No other Australian explorer comes even close to Ludwig Leichhardt in this respect. Typically, the way the land was described in the CSIRO reports, a three-dimensional diagram, a detailed description of the landscape itself, a short description was hilly country in the east of the area, geomorphology, geology, drainage, elevation, climate, and an evaluation of its pastoral potential. And here again, Leichhardt's experience, and one of the reasons why he was so interested in grasses, is he had a very keen appreciation of suitability of land for pastoral potential. And the evaluations that he made along the way are remarkably good. Really can't be faulted. Now, the basic building block of landscape are these land units. And these land units are more discrete. They have a similar soil, a vegetation, a topography, geology, etc., and climate, sorry, all of those things. And they recur in different combinations through the landscape. So this is where the survey, CSIRO survey operations ended up, where we went all the way down to land units, which were still not mapped because it was still reconnaissance, but the inset map of the Fitzroy region up there shows the dark shaded areas where this particular unit was occurring at a high level of probability. That's a stereo image, so with a stereo viewer, that landscape leaps out at you, and you can see where it relates to the other units. It's quite straightforward to take one of these CSIRO reports, sit down with the Port Essington Journal, and proceed to identify these land units along the track. Leichhardt's descriptions, although they're very simple, are more than adequate to track your way all the way through to Port Essington. Okay, now I think Tom and also Rod, have dealt very well with his initial training. I won't repeat any of that, except to say that at the time, there was no single degree that could satisfy Leichhardt's objective of becoming a comprehensively trained naturalist explorer. His focus on the natural sciences developed in his early 20s. It's evident in letters to his father, one of which was read out by Rod, but here's another one. "So long as there are things in natural science of which I am quite unaware, my studies will not be over, if only ways and means allow me to pursue them." The ways and means were always there in the back of his mind. And he has a wry comment in a letter to his brother-in-law, "And as for Humboldt, he set the example that I have never forgotten. My admiration for him is boundless, but I feel that my slender means will always hold me far short of his performance." So he was very well aware of his limited means, and this was a problem for him. Now, I have a great many examples of Leichhardt's prescience, his ability to make very accurate and detailed observations across a range of disciplines, but you've already heard his comment about or suggestion that he arrived in Australia immediately, very shortly anyway, dismissed the notion of an inland sea. And he states this in a letter to one of his professors in Berlin, Heinrich William Dove. "If it be true that the remarkable hot northwesterly winds are masses of air which have been heated and have risen over the tropical part of New Holland, their astonishing dryness would be decisive indication of a desert in the interior of the country." So right then, he knew it was arid out there, before Sturt or before anybody went out there. He wrote, both in the journal and in his letters, wonderful comments. Here's an example. He studied in Paris with Dumerel. He had quite an interest in fish. On the Port Essington expedition, one of his party shot a very large fish in the Mackenzie River, brought it back to camp. Leichhardt was able to identify this fish, which he says, "Murphy shot an osteoglossum." Now, these were known from fossils, Eocene fossils in Europe. And he recognised it. You know, this is one of those, for God's sake. So he preserved it and carried it with him. And he afterwards found this fish in the waters flowing into the Gulf. And in fact, this is the northern, now known to be the northern species. And that's where they went from there. Because he had Gilbert was Gould's collector, a very experienced collector, bird stuffer. Leichhardt really took a bow to Gilbert. He didn't intrude on his field of expertise. And Chisholm wrote papers on the birds of Gilbert's diary and neglected to take into account that Leichhardt actually recorded birds all through his diary. And there's a difference, and that is that Leichhardt recorded nocturnal birds. Gilbert never did, unless he shot one. If he had a specimen, he would record it. But Leichhardt recorded barking owls, nightjars, bearbuck owl, night birds. He knew them from his earlier experience in Australia, those first 2 years. He knew his birds very well, and it's quite obvious. He recorded black swans, which weren't in Gilbert's list. Now, it's true that they weren't always together, They were at the same camp, but they were scouting out. Following, you see a change in colour there. See that change? That's where Gilbert was speared and disappeared. He was no longer part of the expedition. This is the Leichhardt track. As soon as they hit sandstone country, Leichhardt recorded this bird, the sandstone shrike thrush, which has a wonderful song. This is from the Australian Bird Atlas, showing where it's been recorded. But of course, he didn't collect it. And in fact, it wasn't really named for another 30 or 40 years after this. Now we come to the meatier bit. What I've done is to compare and contrast Leichhardt with some of the greats of his contemporaries of the period. Humboldt, of course, who lived to a very old age, Darwin, Alfred Russel Wallace, and von Mueller. And there are some very interesting homologies involved with these people. In every case, they were expected to take a different track in their professional development, but all became enamoured of the natural world and went off in their separate ways. Probably the most conservative member from that respect is von Mueller, who actually completed a PhD in botany in Kiel University. And he was very much the botanist, but rather more than that. But these others had very broad interests, very different original beginnings, but all of them in their late 20s, mid to late 20s and early 30s had their wanderjahr experience. Von Humboldt in Central and South America, but apart from that, a lot of travel in Europe. Darwin, of course, the voyage on the Beagle. Leichhardt with his three expeditions. Alfred Russel Wallace, his first expedition to the Amazon with Bates, which ended in disaster. His collections and most of his notes were lost at sea when their ship caught fire. They were lucky to survive. But he came back from that, and then he went to the Malay Archipelago. And it's just illustrating in each case Humboldt, Darwin, and Leichhardt, and Wallace, but not so much Mueller, all established reputations on the basis of the expedition reports. Voyage of the Beagle, Journal to Port Essington, and von Humboldt's marvellous account of his time in Central and South America. But their great works took many, many years to gestate. Many years. In the case of Humboldt, I mean, his grand epic piece, Cosmos, he didn't start till he was 79. And it's really trying to illustrate that the field experience and the collections and the notes and the observations are one thing, but synthesizing those, producing the synthesis of all of this work takes time. And the problem for Ludwig Leichhardt was he didn't get time. He disappeared at age 35. So we'll never know, in some respects, what he would have produced. I can give you... Look, there's so many things. He met Humboldt, he was in correspondence with Humboldt. All four of the people below Humboldt were greatly influenced by Humboldt, corresponded with Humboldt, and revered him. And in fact, you know, Darwin, I won't read it, it's too soppy. But I could find no evidence that Leichhardt was aware of Darwin's great work. Of course, his theory of evolution occurred much later, 1859. By that time, Leichhardt was long gone. But on the voyage back from their rescue from Port Essington, on the Heroine, just beyond Cape Melville, Leichhardt had a chance to examine a coral reef. And he says, "The theory of Darwin becomes more and more improbable. There must be another, more satisfactory explanation," because he was referring to Darwin's concept of the subsiding volcanic mountain, subsiding below the sea, and the reefs progressively growing upward to compensate for that sinking. And his evidence was that, well, as far as he could see, the coastline there was rising, not sinking, and it took another 40 or 50 years to establish that corals actually can grow whether it's rising, subsiding, or even stable sea level. And that's the only evidence I could find that he had actually had contact or knowledge of Darwin. The botanical work has been referred to by Tom, and we have some excellent recent papers which evaluate that. What we haven't had any real discussions of are the ethnobotany component. Leichhardt was quite remarkable. He would taste or eat anything that he felt had some potential value. And through the journal, there are lots, almost daily, there are comments on, you know, the little seven tree had a yellow or red three-capsular fruit with a thin, fleshy pericarp of an exceedingly bitter taste. And that was the quinine tree, Petalostigma pubescens. Then he has other comments like, "The emu here feeds on the fruits of this little seven tree, which is so excessively bitter as to impart its quality to the meat and even to the gizzard and the very marrow." He was a great feeder on emus. But he checked and tested and ate, certainly to the disadvantage of his mouth and his gizzard, quite often. But they ate the native portulaca, the pigweed, and it's quite true that none of his men suffered from scurvy, as did a number of other explorers. Another really interesting point to me is his medical background, which he did make use of on a number of occasions, both on the voyage out and at settlements that he visited where people had eye problems and other difficulties. He even performed an operation on a young lad, which I won't go into. But at the attack up in the Gulf where Gilbert was speared to death, two other members of the party were very savagely speared and bashed. They had multiple wounds, barbed spears. The barbed spears had to be pushed through or cut out. Now, when you think about that, here they are in the middle of nowhere with all of these terrible wounds, no antibiotics. These guys live to be old men. And he actually treated them, doctored them that night and the following morning. And later on in the journal, he describes a tree. And just in passing, he says, "A small green-looking tree had wood of a brown colour which smelt like raspberry jam. And upon burning it, the ashes produced a very strong lye, an alkaline solution, which I used in dressing the wounds of my companions." And this is the gutta percha tree, which has a rubbery exudate. He burnt that tree and he used that in dressing the wounds of his companions. They survived.
It's time. Yeah.
Yep.
Please.
Can I have just one final?
Sure. Okay.
I really wanted to... We've still got that up there. All of these people contributed to the development of the growing science of both ecology and landscape ecology. But ecology was first named by Ernst Haeckel, another German, 1866, so long after Leichhardt disappeared. Landscape ecology, not until 1939, by Karl Troll, an Austrian, but another German speaker. And journals for landscape ecology were not published until 1987. But these people contributed to the development of those disciplines, and Leichhardt particularly so. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Henry. And yet again, we see the breadth of this man. And indeed, what a loss to science, and a tragic loss. And as you say, everyone else got their opportunity to write their great work, and Leichhardt never got there because his remains are out there, most likely in the desert somewhere. So, one or two questions before lunch. Jeremy?
Jeremy.
Professor Nix and the two previous speakers, Jeremy Spencer, National Museum of Australia. 11 years ago, I had occasion to go to Vienna and work in the Natural Historic Museum on Baron Karl Freiherr von Hügel and searched thousands and thousands of herbarium specimens in the museum, in the Natural History Museum. What I found there was that there was the whole history of Australian botanical science that had never been touched by people like Hooker and Kew and in Paris, but it was still in pristine condition. And I'm almost 100% certain I saw original Leichhardt specimens with little annotated labels there. I just bring it to your attention because...
Fantastic.
As far as the Austrians are concerned, everything was survived the war because it was kept in the salt mines at Salzburg, and the only stuff that was lost was some of the conifers, which are duplicate specimens in Belgium.
Right.
Just sort of brought to your attention. Thank you.
Thank you. Many... Leichhardt collected for many people, and this, I think this was partly commercial. I mean, he would have received some payment. And some of those specimens were probably traded, so, and certainly they do with zoological specimens. So they can be, you know, like, for instance, Gilbert's specimens of the birds that he collected are found in museums both sides of the Atlantic, about four or five different museums in Europe, a few in England, places you'd least expect them. And they've finally been tracked down, almost to the last specimen. But as I said, unfortunately, only a few new species were added up to the point where Gilbert was killed.
I can see there are some further questions, but if you wouldn't mind keeping them for the discussion this afternoon... Thank you very much, Henry, once again.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.